Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On the show today, Ireland votes overwhelmingly to lift its ban on abortion, celebrating the Muslim holy month of Ramadan in Norway, where the sun never sets.
It doesn't take much imagination to realise that not eating anything for 23 hours and then breaking fast for the remaining 60 minutes is neither comfortable nor particularly healthy.
And a huge scandal at Germany's migration agency, where workers are accused of possibly taking bribes for asylum applications. These stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. Last week, Ireland voted overwhelmingly to lift its constitutional ban on abortion. 3 years after becoming the first country to allow same-sex marriage by a popular vote, 66% of the electorate decided to allow abortions to happen in Ireland. It represents a massive societal change in attitudes in a country that, under massive influence from the Catholic Church, was once one of the most conservative in Europe. Our reporter, Sean Defoe, was in Dublin Castle for the historic result and brings us this report.
And I said, hey, yeah, yeah.
All together.
Hey, yeah, yeah. I said, hey. Repeal the eight.
At the end of last month, Ireland voted overwhelmingly to lift the constitutional ban on abortion.
Under the Eighth Amendment, we said to women in crisis, take the boat or take the plane. Today we say, take our hands.
It was an emphatic yes vote which removed the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, which had equated the right to life of the mother and her unborn child. It was removed by a 2-1 majority, a complete reversal of the referendum that put the Eighth into the Constitution in the first place back in 1983. The Prime Minister, or Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, hailed the result as a success for the women of Ireland.
It's the culmination of a quiet revolution that's been taking place in Ireland over the past couple of decades. The public have spoken. The result appears to be resounding in favour of repealing the Eighth Amendment. Men and women, almost every age group and every social class. And that demonstrates to me that we are a country that is not divided.
While the leader of the left-wing party, Sinn Féin, Mary Lou MacDonald, said the vote shows how much Ireland has changed in the past three decades.
Of course, I'm absolutely delighted to see our country move in a direction that I passionately believe in. That's a new Ireland and, you know, an open society, a society that's happy and that's comfortable in its own skin. And this is another one of those big leaps forward. I think it was the last throw of the dice for the old Ireland. And now we can move forward. And I just think that's brilliant, not just for me. I'm saying this not just as a politician, I'm saying this as a woman, as a person, as a mother, as all of those things. So it's just a great day.
As the results were announced in the courtyard of Dublin Castle, the mood elevated as 39 of the 40 constituencies returned yes votes. Even the heart of rural, traditional Catholic Ireland voted to liberalise Ireland's abortion laws. Minister for Children, Catherine Zappone, has campaigned for this for years and got caught up in the emotion.
I suppose as an independent member of this government, it was one of my prime priorities to join Fine Gael if they would be willing to put a referendum to the people on to repeal the Eighth Amendment. And so they agreed. We set up a citizens' assembly, a process that I think really supported and led to this really resounding result.
When you look at the margin that we saw in the end, did you ever imagine it?
I did not. What I would like...
And we could just hear the people here. That sums it up really, doesn't it?
It sure does. It sure does. And I suppose last time I was here with the people out there, it was for the 34th Amendment. I do think what we learned in the 34th was the platform that brought us to such a resounding result in the 36th.
But now the focus has turned from the historic referendum results to how to implement it. The landslide nature of the result has removed a lot of the political opposition to the legislation, with many of the members of Parliament who had advocated a no vote saying they'll go with the will of the people and support the proposed new laws. They are to allow abortion without restriction for up to 12 weeks into pregnancy, and after that for terminations to be legal when there's a fatal fetal abnormality involved or when there's a risk to the life or serious risk to the health or mental health of the woman. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, has warned it could be some months before those laws take effect.
We will need clinical guidelines as well, and it will be necessary to regulate and license the new medicines. It's still our anticipation that it will be at the end of the year, 1st of January 2019, before we have fully given effect to the will of the people, even with the best intentions.
In a strange twist, the move to make changes to the proposed law is now coming from the left-wing parliamentarians who voted yes in the first place. The Labour Party's Ivana Bacik and Solidarity's Ruth Coppinger want immediate changes.
But we could immediately move to delete the criminal sanction from the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act, so at least to remove the chill factor and the fear for women and for doctors. And I think accompanying that, we could also see legislation, just again, very simple amending bill, just to repeal the 1995 Regulation of Information Act. Because, again, it's wrong that doctors would still not be able to refer women to England for terminations of pregnancy, still not be able to provide medical notes once the people have spoken.
Every vestige of penalising women and of criminalising women should be removed now, that can be removed now. So, for example, an instruction should be issued to the HPRA, who currently intercept the abortion pills that women order online through sites like Women on Web and others, to cease that practice, to stop seizing abortion pills that women have ordered.
While there's also some concern from Leo Varadkar that women in Northern Ireland, where abortions are still illegal, will travel south for terminations here when the law changes.
My initial impression is that this will be treated like a normal health service, and it's already the case that women who are resident in Northern Ireland and indeed women who are Irish citizens can travel to Ireland and avail of healthcare. You'll already have the case of people who live along the border and their GP might be south of the border, and we do have people who already come to our hospitals from Northern Ireland for healthcare.
And so they wake in the morning and they say goodbye, and they take a deep breath and they get on a flight, and we scream at the top of our lungs, what's going on?
No one predicted the emphatic nature of the result of the abortion referendum. Many hailed it as a victory for women's rights, while others called it a sad day for the country. But for now, the pro-life lobby in the Parliament in Leinster House have taken a big step back in the face of a mighty backlash from the electorate. And it shows in stark terms the ongoing separation between the people of Ireland and the Catholic Church that held so much influence for so long. Sean Defoe in Dublin.
This is Inside Europe. Germany's Interior Minister apologised during the week for a scandal engulfing the Federal Office for Migration and Refugees, or BAMF, the local acronym. Public sector employees have been accused of mishandling asylum applications and possibly taking bribes. DW political correspondent Thomas Sparrow is with me. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, Keith. Nice to be with you.
You too. Now, the office in Bremen is at the heart of this scandal for reportedly approving hundreds of applications without sufficiently evaluating them. Now, that office has been prohibited from deciding any more asylum applications, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it?
It does seem it's the tip of the iceberg. What's been now at least discussed is that it's alleged that that Bremen branch of BAMF simply admitted around 1,200 refugees to Germany without reviewing their cases properly. And obviously that has created a lot of questions as to, well, first and foremost, why that happened, whether, as you mentioned, also bribes were in any way involved, who has the political responsibility behind that, whether other branches of the BAMF were also involved. This is obviously a very delicate issue here in Germany because, well, you may know that, and our listeners as well, but obviously since the refugee crisis a few years ago, refugee topics are the most controversial and sensitive topics in German politics. So the fact that the agency in charge of deciding who comes into Germany, who is allowed in Germany and who must leave, is embroiled in such a scandal is obviously very big and very delicate news here in Germany.
It's a major embarrassment to Chancellor Angela Merkel's open door policy to refugees, isn't it?
It is indeed. You may remember a few years ago when she said that famous catchphrase, "Wir schaffen das," or "we will manage." Well, obviously, when she said "we will manage," she was also looking at the Office for Migrants and Refugees, because ultimately they are the ones that will be deciding who comes to Germany and who doesn't come to Germany, or who is allowed to stay and who isn't allowed to stay. So the fact that this office is not handling the applications as it should do is a very big topic for her, obviously also for her interior minister, Horst Seehofer, who's a member of the CSU, that's the Bavaria sister party of Angela Merkel's CDU, who came to the interior ministry on a sort of law and order idea, trying to make sure that Germany handles much better all these asylum applications. And it's turned into a very big problem for himself, a problem, in fact, right at the beginning of his tenure as interior minister.
Now, there's 13 other regional BAMF branches have apparently also come under scrutiny for showing noticeable differences in the number of asylum applications accepted or rejected in comparison to other offices. Now, how deep does this scandal go?
Well, that is a question, obviously, that many here are trying to answer. There's obviously an investigative group, not only by regional officers, but also national officials dealing with this. Obviously, there's the corruption investigation into the official in charge of the office. And then obviously there's something else which is particularly important, namely that 70 people will be reevaluating around 18,000 cases. This could just create a lot of delay in asylum applications in Germany, which is obviously, again, a very big problem for the country, because the idea a few years ago was to make all these application decisions faster. So it's indeed a very difficult situation now politically, but also for, I guess, some of the people who are arriving here in Germany who want their asylum applications to be resolved as quickly as possible and also in a correct way.
Those statistics, you say 18,000 people will have to have their asylum applications rechecked. Now, those are a lot of vulnerable people behind those numbers. We're talking people who have fled war zones. They've put their lives at risk to get to Europe. Now, migrants who have had their applications accepted, they could find themselves being deported, could they?
Well, that is one of the sensitive issues here. We're obviously talking on the one hand about the political implications, about the problems that Angela Merkel as Chancellor or Horst Seehofer as Interior Minister are facing. But there's obviously the other aspect of the story, namely that we're talking here about a lot of people who, as you say, are vulnerable people who fled their countries of origin, who arrived in Germany and who are obviously waiting for that decision to be announced. And they have every right to expect, as also every other person in this country, that those asylum applications will be decided not only quickly, but also correctly.
So how is this going to be resolved, this mess?
Well, first and foremost, we have to wait for the results of these investigations that are being carried out. There's also a possibility that there could be a parliamentary committee, although that's still not clear. And then there's obviously the big decision as to who will take the political blame. That's something that's still being discussed here in Germany. There's still a lot of questions that haven't been answered here, whether more branches were also involved, who knew what, when, the political responsibility of this. I would say, Keith, that this is only the beginning of what could become a really big problem here in Germany for Angela Merkel.
Thomas Sparrow, thank you very much for joining us on Inside Europe.
Always a pleasure, Keith.
I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Virtual reality, role-playing, board games. Most people would assume such pursuits were mere leisure activities, but game-playing and cutting-edge technology are increasingly being adopted by NGOs as they try to support campaigns for social change, and that's especially true in the former Soviet space. The Czech capital, Prague, has just hosted the second annual Unlock conference, bringing together more than 200 activists, campaigners, journalists, tech experts and civil society donors from around the region. Rob Cameron was there and has this report.
A video advertising the services of Arlupa, a game and app development company from Armenia that specialises in augmented and virtual reality. Arlupa has a long list of clients from Coca-Cola to Audi, but as co-founder and CEO Arman Atoyan explains, AR and VR are technologies that are now increasingly being used by the non-profit sector.
It's a usage in art, it's a usage in storytelling, it's the usage of even civil activism. And those tools now are coming to help people to use, let's say, old techniques in a totally different way. So now they can use the tech to, for example, just like simple examples, imagine you are walking in the city and you want to see like how the city was looking like 100 years ago. So you are just pointing your phone in different buildings and seeing the stories of dead buildings and during like that old times. Or even it's possible to make monuments to come alive. And we did that type of project a year ago with the government for the Ministry of Culture. And the idea was to make monuments to come alive and tell their stories. So those tools now changing the way that people are interacting with the content.
Up a flight of stairs in the sprawling former barracks hosting this year's Unlock event, groups of mostly Russian-speaking activists from across the former Soviet Union are seated around tables, board games, counters and dice spread out before them. This is another fascinating area being used to benefit the non-profit sector, gaming. These players are absorbed in a game devised by board games publisher Sergei Golubkin from Moscow. As well as localizing Western games for the Russian market, Sergei's company has started publishing games for civic activism, including one that helps protesters game out various scenarios of what they can and can't do on the streets.
Yes, board games, it's not just for kids, it's very good for education. It's not boring, and people can really receive this information in civic activism and social projects. It's also really good. We have, I think, 5 projects about discrimination, about street law, protests.
And they allow the players to practice, to game different courses of action, I guess, and strategies and cooperation.
It gives information. So how it works, you can feel and try all strategies, methodologies, and you know what is now good or bad, what strategies are working or not. So it's like simulation. You can try different roles in the justice process and different stages from first steps when you ask all participants and then the process itself.
As you all know, innovation is a big buzzword that can mean nothing or anything, but for me there are two elements that
Unlock is organized by a relatively new Prague-based NGO called the Prague Civil Society Center, created with the aim of nurturing a community of activists, professionals and academics across the former Soviet space, from Belarus to Kyrgyzstan and seemingly everywhere in between. It's a diverse set of countries, each with different opportunities and limitations, as innovations advisor Philip Nubel explains.
Indeed, a lot of regimes are getting more authoritarian. You also have encouraging examples, things that are happening in Ukraine, in Georgia. So, of course, nothing is black and white, and you have to constantly push forward. And there are some setbacks, even though in the countries that I mentioned. But I think that precisely when you provide creativity, new technology, you basically give hope to people because, it's, as you said, it's quite depressing. You burn out easily, and you have to do things also differently because we live in an age of social media. And if you're not part of this conversation, people don't just don't know about you.
Surprisingly, none of the half a dozen or so activists I spoke to said they'd had any major troubles with the authorities in a region not known for encouraging civil society and local grassroots activism. Several, in fact, were working with the authorities to improve the societies in which they lived. As they talked, a couple of beefy security guards stood at the entrance to the barracks, hired by the organizers to keep an eye on who was coming in. Thankfully, it seems their powers of persuasion were never called upon, but it did serve as a reminder that NGO work is not always universally welcomed, even in a relatively liberal Western city. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
We're around halfway through the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. That's when followers around the world engage in spiritual reflection and charitable acts. They are also expected to fast every day between sunrise and sunset. But what happens if the sun never sets where you live? Lars Bevanger has this postcard from Norway.
The Islamic calendar follows the lunar calendar, making the year around 10 days shorter than the solar year. As a result, the month of Ramadan moves through the seasons, and this year it so happens to coincide nearly to the day with the arrival of the midnight sun in the Arctic north of Norway. Now, the Quran says a Muslim should fast during the month of Ramadan from sunrise, when the white thread of dawn appears to you distinct from the black thread. The problem many Muslims in Norway have right now, of course, is that there is no distinction between those white and black threads at all. The last time the sun actually set in the Arctic city of Tromsø was in mid-May, and then it was gone for only 27 minutes. Personally, I have never attempted to fast, but it doesn't take much imagination to realise that not eating anything for 23 hours and then breaking fast for the remaining 60 minutes is neither comfortable nor particularly healthy. The last time Ramadan coincided so closely with the Arctic summer was in the mid-1980s, when the Muslim population in the north of Norway was extremely small. Today, many Arctic communities have a sizable Muslim population. The Al-Noor Mosque in Tromsø counts around 1,000 members. Like all Muslim congregations north of the Arctic Circle, they now have to try to figure out how to best interpret both scripture and edicts from scholars in order to do the right thing. Ramadan is a time for reflection, to better yourself, and a time for spiritual cleansing. You don't achieve any of that if you put your health at risk, a young member of the Al-Noor Mosque told me. She and the others in Tromsø have arrived at a solution. Follow the hours of Mecca, which is approximately the same distance from the equator as Tromsø is from the North Pole. The result? A far more manageable fasting time from around 4 in the morning till 7 in the evening. Yet other mosques inside the Arctic Circle believe it is more correct to follow the times of the nearest city, which actually does have a sunrise and a sunset. Others believe the right thing is to look to the nearest Muslim country, which most Norwegian Muslims consider to be Turkey. As Ramadan gradually moves away from the midnight sun season, things will also gradually become easier for those who fast. Until, of course, Ramadan again falls during the winter months, when the sun never rises. Lars Bevanger, DW, Norway.
It's always a pleasure to present Inside Europe, and if you'd like to contact the team, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is europe@dw.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if you enjoy the show, tell your friends to check us out on Inside Europe. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the next half an hour, investor anxiety after Turkey's lira currency plunges in value. The far-right Golden Dawn Party regroups in Greece. A little robot that can speak and hear breaks the isolation for hundreds of children who take time off school because of illness.
The AV1 robot is something that I first saw come up on social media, and I was thinking, wow, what if my child could have one of those? And then when we actually got the opportunity for Julia to get one, I mean, the joy was through the roof. We were literally dancing around the living room.
And we'll hear some unique organic sounds from food with Vienna's Vegetable Orchestra. Stay tuned for these stories and more. Turkey's currency has lost more than 10% in value against the dollar in the last month alone. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan triggered investor anxiety when he said he wanted a greater say in monetary policy if he wins this month's elections. The plunging lira comes at a bad time for Erdogan, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Istanbul's Sirkeci district is filled with small businesses, and nearly on every street corner there's a money changer. Large neon signs record the wild fluctuations of the Turkish lira, and local shop owner Hassan is watching nervously.
The dollar is flying. We don't know where it's going. We don't know where we're going.
Hassan is not alone. Inside one money changer, Ahmed is changing his meager savings into dollars.
It's affecting our purchasing power every day. I'm retired and my pension is now less than $300.
Opposition parties are blaming President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for these currency woes. Erdogan's monetary policy is unorthodox. He insists that interest rates need to be cut rather than raised to rein in double-digit inflation that's caused international investors to flee the Turkish market. That in turn prompted the lira to nosedive. Sinan Ülgen is the head of the Istanbul-based İDAM think tank. He says the economic situation is now dominating this month's presidential and general elections.
Everybody in Turkey nowadays have been talking about the exchange rate. So everybody is aware of what is happening. And this cannot be good for the government. The opposition will surely be trying to capitalize on this episode. But at the same time, the government's response has been that this is by no means a consequence of economic mismanagement. On the contrary, it is because all those foreigners that don't like Turkey's progress have been attacking the Turkish currency. Given the state of affairs with regard to the Turkish media, this is a narrative that is being constantly disseminated, and it has indeed gained some significant traction.
But Erdogan is on the offensive. Here in Turkey, there's a rich vein of suspicion, if not outright xenophobia, towards foreigners, especially amongst nationalist voters who support the government. And the president is using that to his advantage.
Hey, George! Hey, Hans! Bizi yıkamayacaksınız.
At this campaign rally, Erdogan says Hans and George are responsible for the lira's record low. That's the way he often refers to Germany and the United States. A major hike in interest rates has for now partially reversed the lira slide. And political scientist Cengiz Aktar thinks Erdogan could turn the currency woes to his advantage.
Turkey now has the highest interest rates in the world among the emerging economies after Argentina. But the voters of Mr. Erdogan won't make the link between the very high interest rates, which will kill the economic activity in the midterm, and today. They will just see the result that suddenly, without asking why, suddenly Turkish lira is appreciating. It's a perfect operation.
Bugün baktığımızda yatay 4.46 seviyesinde, 4.45'e yakın yine.
Nearly all the mainstream media are government controlled. So not surprisingly, they echo the government line of conspiracies and praise Erdogan for defeating them. but recent polls put business and consumer confidence at a 15-month low and indicate that the number one concern of voters is the economy. Analyst Sinan Ülgen warns the lira remains vulnerable to further falls, so there could still be a political fallout.
As this is becoming more and more visible, and it may even start to impact people's lives, pass through to inflation, rising oil, gas prices, rising water bills, and so on, this will also become an issue going forward if this current tension continues.
The elections this month are shaping up to be one of the most unpredictable in recent years. Erdogan is accustomed to easy electoral victories, but voters may blame him for the precarious state of the lira. Opinion polls indicate that Erdogan's lead over the opposition has narrowed. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Violent crimes, lawless rampages, and most worrying, a rise in right-wing attacks. The far-right Golden Dawn Party is regrouping and showing its teeth. Other, smaller, copycat groups have also emerged, fanning the rate and intensity of far-right attacks. Anthony Karasova reports from the Greek capital.
Hate crimes in Greece have increased by some 300%, surging from a total number of 48 cases to 133 in the span of a year. And that, officials say, after the number of far-right attacks had already doubled the previous year in 2016. Final, up-to-date statistics for the running months are not yet available, but the rising numbers have pundits, politicians and police on edge. Hate crimes and far-right hits are gaining a dangerous momentum here. Just last weekend, more than 22 people were arrested when mobs of neo-Nazi supporters wielding crowbars and metal rods clashed with anti-fascist groups on the outskirts of the Greek capital. That attack alone followed the brutal assault of a pair of Pakistani migrants at an outdoor market north of the Greek capital. In their testimony, migrants told police they were clobbered before an audience of locals during Ramadan, the Muslim holy month. Hate crimes in Greece include attacks targeting race, religion, sexual orientation, gender and disability. Political beliefs now are also being targeted. Reeling from a devastating debt crisis, surging unemployment, and an ever-shrinking economy, many Greeks disappointed by the country's long-standing political elite have streamed to the side of far-right groups like Golden Dawn, venting their anger and pain from the crisis. A crackdown on the neo-Nazi party managed to defang the organization, keeping it on the sidelines for several years. But now supporters are regrouping, flexing their muscle anew, inspiring also a rash of copycat groups on a new, more patriotic tune. The timing of this resurgence is crucial. Next to the economy, the government in Athens is grappling with two major foreign policy problems, the first of which is Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the increasingly authoritarian Turkish president who is repeatedly contesting Greece's borders in the Aegean Sea. The second issue is the government's compromising stance on a bizarre name dispute between Greece and Macedonia. While the far-left government of Alexis Tsipras looks willing to allow the tiny Balkan state to use the word Macedonia with some sort of a qualifier, most conservative-minded Greeks want to torpedo that deal to block any use of a name linked to one of the country's most legendary warriors, Alexander the Great. Both issues have stirred nationwide debate, and both have fanned the flames of nationalism, firing up a new spate of attacks by far-right extremists. The latest victim, a popular Greek mayor who was attacked last week while attending a remembrance ceremony honoring Greek victims of mass killings by Turks during the First World War. The liberal centrist Yanis Boutaris was initially accosted, but as ominous crowds of black-clad men grew around him, the 75-year-old elected official was pelted with water bottles and then thrown to the ground, punched, kicked, and injured in the head, back, and legs. Three suspected far-right supporters received suspended jail sentences, a ruling viewed as a mere slap on the wrist for the assailants as they were allowed to walk free. Golden Dawn has since then praised the hit, applauding the mob that carried out the attack. Far-right activists are already planning a spray of nationwide anti-Macedonia rallies, hoping to knock down the government's design to accept a compromising name solution. Authorities concede they're bracing for mayhem that's bound to shoot up far-right attacks even further. Antikara Sava, DW, Athens.
You're listening to Inside Europe. Coming up within 10 minutes, childhood obesity, and British lawmakers want characters such as Tony the Tiger, the Milky Bar Kid, and the Honey Monster banned from promoting sugary cereals. Paddy Cunningham, who is runner-up of the Irish reality TV show The Biggest Loser, joins us to discuss whether the most important meal of the day, that's breakfast, needs an overhaul.
Cereal in particular is a convenient food, as are ready meals and stuff like that. So I think cereals definitely have become a go-to food in the mornings because of the way they're marketed. Yes, not because necessarily of a cartoon character on the front, but because of the way this is a food you should eat at breakfast time.
That's coming up very soon, but first, a little robot that can speak and hear and who raises its head when you talk to it is breaking the isolation for hundreds of children who have to spend sometimes long periods away from school because of illness. It was invented and is most widely used in Norway. John Lawrenson headed to Sola, a small town on Norway's western coastline, to meet one of the robots and its owner.
Hello, amigo.
Hello. Yeah. Julia.
Yeah. Hi.
Sat on her sofa at home, 15-year-old Julia Miller, her mum is Norwegian, her dad American, opens an application on her computer and switches on a little white robot that's on her desk at school. His head lifts and his eyes light up as she says hi to her classmates who are about to start their classes for the day.
I'm Julia. I'm into technological stuff. I like building things.
Your dad said, yeah.
Yeah, I like video games a lot on my computer, and I like art and drawing.
Julia has complex regional pain syndrome, or CRPS. It's a chronic condition caused by confused communication between the brain and the peripheral nervous system. The brain signals there's something terribly wrong, generating excruciating pain, when in fact there's nothing wrong. It started in her foot when she was 11 before spreading to her whole body when she was 12.
For about 2.5 years when I first got the sickness, I was home like 90% of the time. I was isolated. I could barely talk to my friends. I wasn't connected to any of the teachers, and I could barely do any schoolwork because I wouldn't know what I was going to do. With the AV1 robot, then I can participate in class, pay attention to what the teacher is saying, so I'm not just going by what says on the computer. I could be a part of group projects with my friends and stuff. You can talk and communicate, and you can push a button that's a light on top of the AV1 robot's head, so you can show that, like, you think you know the answer or you have a question. I can also turn the robot 360 degrees, like, all the way around, which is pretty cool. I like seeing, like, other classmates seeing their reaction when I move the head, and they're like, whoa. Then when I have a really bad day, then I don't always leave my bed or anything, and I can't always sit up, so I can lay in bed in my pajamas, and you can see on my face, like, I'm pale and I don't feel well at all. And nobody has to see that with a robot. I just see what's going on over there.
I have a microphone. I thought it was you, but it was a different microphone. Welcome to Norway.
Thank you. In Oslo, I visit the company that makes the AV1. The company is called No Isolation. Its founding principle is to provide solutions for different forms of isolation. So its newest product, for example, is aimed at bringing screen-to-screen communication to digitally illiterate seniors. One of its founders, Anna Holmheider, says isolation is a big global problem, but one that's particularly acute in Norway because of the large distances, sparse population and harsh climate.
Over 7% of Europe's population consider themselves severe lonely. So No Isolation is based on a very fundamental thought of helping people out of loneliness. So we want to build technology that will actually assist people in getting connected back to society and getting back into the greater community.
But are you solving the problem? You're not actually bringing people closer together physically.
Yeah, but technology is a great way to bring people together. And you have all these discussions that technology are bringing people apart, like it's creating distance. But I really think that we have to look at the possibilities that are given to us by technology. If you can be in the classroom, you see what's going on, you hear what's going on, you can keep track of who's dating who or what teacher is being really angry at times. Like, you want to be a part of your daily society, and technology makes it possible.
There are now over 400 of these robots in use, but the company says millions of children around the world miss months of school each year, so the scope for expansion is big. No Isolation believes it will have between 2,000 and 4,000 AV1s in operation by the end of this year. As for the cost, some are rented out at €2,000 a year, some sold to schools for €2,500 plus €100 monthly fee for 4G support and insurance. Quite a lot of money, perhaps, for what is quite a technologically simple device, but for people like Julia, it has been a life changer. This is her mother, Cecily.
The AV1 robot is something that I first saw come up on social media, and I was thinking, wow, what if my child could have one of those? And then when we actually got the opportunity for Julia to get one, sponsored through a foundation that works to end isolation for sick kids, the joy was through the roof. We were literally dancing around the living room at the opportunity of getting this robot. And it's just such an enormous change to have a child 2.5 years losing all her friends to now being able to not just follow school, but maintain friendships. And that's just been incredible.
Jeg skal skru av roboten nå. Ha det.
Å ja, ok, greit. Ja vel. Ha det.
Ha det.
John Lawrenson, DW, Sula, Norway.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. In an effort to tackle childhood obesity rates, British lawmakers want characters such as Tony the Tiger, the Milky Bar Kid and the Honey Monster banned from promoting unhealthy snacks. To discuss, I'm joined by Paddy Cunningham, who's runner-up of the Irish television show The Biggest Loser. Paddy lost 120 pounds in just 5 months, which is more than a third of his body weight. He's now working on a new fitness video series, The Curvy Coach, coming this summer. Hello, Paddy.
Hello there, how's things?
Yeah, good, thanks. Now, celebrity TV chef Jamie Oliver says that cartoons and superheroes should not be used to, quote, peddle rubbish. Is he right?
I would disagree, I have to say. I think if we're thinking that cartoon characters are the cause of childhood obesity, then that's wrong. I think ultimately it's going to come back to people's knowledge and understanding about the true causes of obesity and starting to tackle that from a young age, as opposed to, you know, looking at cartoon characters. If we're starting there, you know, where's it going to go to next? Are we going to be looking at comic books and saying, oh, we need to get rid of characters like Desperate Dan and people like that? So I think it is a bit misplaced.
What is the true cause of obesity?
Well, I think scientifically, if you want to go there, obviously it's people over-consuming energy that they don't need. But I think ultimately in society terms, it comes back to a true understanding of, you know, what healthy eating is, about people understanding the types of foods, the quantity of foods that they need to be eating, also understanding their relationship with food. So on an emotional level, are there particular scenarios or situations that cause you to use food as a crutch? Food is often seen as an addictive substance, and that's something that I would agree with. It definitely can be something that is addictive, as can, you know, gambling and other activities. But I think if we look at, you know, the nutritional knowledge of people, their awareness of their emotions, and then also, of course, their activity levels. And that is something that we are seeing throughout society is that people are becoming more active, particularly with, I think, kind of the teenage into early 20s. There's been a huge increase in people becoming more active within that age range. But that's the three areas that I would see that focus would need to be put on is nutritional awareness, emotional awareness, and then activity levels.
Now, talking about nutrition, if the cartoons are taken off the cereal boxes, what's on the inside is going to be the same. So, I mean, could obese kids be the result of lazy parents rather than cartoon characters?
I don't know if I'd say it's lazy parents. I think it's maybe more so cereal in particular is a convenient food, as are ready meals and stuff like that. So I think cereals definitely have become a go-to food in the mornings because of the way they're marketed. Yes, not because necessarily of a cartoon character on the front, but because of the way this is a food you should eat at breakfast time, which, you know, it isn't necessarily a requirement of any particular food. But as you say, the food inside will still be the same. What I think would be more encouraging would be more awareness, more openness, and more promotion about the breakdown of the nutritional value. You know, some companies have brought in the kind of traffic light system of red, amber, green, depending on, you know, the type of, say, fats or sugars or that are in food. And I think that's a more positive way to be going about it, and opening up that discussion and building that into the educational system from a very young age as well.
And what would you say is a more nutritional breakfast to a cereal, sugared cereal?
Well, ultimately, anything that comes from natural sources, so your fruits, your veggies, your unprocessed meats, things like that will be deemed a more higher biological value to your body. And that will be a good kind of starting point for your day.
And at what point in your life did you decide to lose weight?
For myself, I was approaching 30 and I kind of thought, you know what, my quality of life is not good. By that point, I guess I had somewhat bought into fad diets and stuff like that as well and had kind of seen that they didn't work for me and was in a vicious cycle of trying a fad diet and then that emotional aspect of, oh, well, it's not working, so therefore I'll comfort myself with food. And I'd been going through that cycle for years. And it was really, okay, I'm hitting 30, something needs to change here because I'm feeling out of breath if I'm going up upstairs, practical things like trying to buy clothes, flying on a plane, being uncomfortable. And it really was a decision of, I can't go on like this and something has to change.
All right, Paddy Cunningham, thanks for joining us on Inside Europe. Our next report gives a whole new meaning to the expression playing with your food. In the city of Mozart and Strauss in Vienna, a biodegradable ensemble composes unique organic sounds from food. Although their instruments are boiled down and eaten after each performance, this year the Vegetable Orchestra is celebrating 20 years of surprises and reinventions. Christian Cummins went along to one of their rehearsals.
A violin improvised from two leeks, a flute made by drilling into a cucumber, a sort of trumpet carved from a pumpkin. These are just some of the instruments that the members of Vienna's cult Vegetable Orchestra are carefully working into shape around a table in the city's 4th district, blowing into the instruments to test the sounds, and then carving and drilling some more to improve the tone. So, are vegetables natural wonders of musicality? Here's founding member Matthias Meinhartner.
Actually, it's a very bad material to make music out of. It's actually a challenge to make music, and that's, I think, the main idea, to make music on something that's challenging you to do music on.
It's a challenge of adaptability and of innovation. That takes patience and a love of the absurd, as well as a love of, let's say, unusual sounds.
I can take the leek violin, which is actually for me a very, as a, from the sound, it's very vegetable, I would say. And also the kind of playing is for me very unique because you take two leeks. Yeah? The one is the body, and the other leek is the bow. And then you rub it against each other. And these, let's say, the strings inside the structure of the leek, they're kind of making this squeaking noise, like a torture rat or so. It's like. And this is a sound is hard to play also because it's not working always. So yeah, I think it's very vegetable.
Susanna Gartmeier, who has a background in the fine arts and plays a regular bass clarinet in her spare time, has been performing with the Vegetable Orchestra for 12 years now. And she says it's a constantly evolving process.
I don't know how many instruments we invented during the time, really lots. And it's also the fact that everyone specialized in some instruments and there are many schools of building instruments. So some people think the flute has to be built like that and other people have another school of building the flute, and yeah, so it's a constant process actually to invent new ways of playing vegetables.
A Stradivarius violin can become a valuable family heirloom, but the life cycle of a vegetable instrument is as short as that of a mayfly. The day of the concert begins in the outside market. A dash to the iconic Naschmarkt in central Vienna, for example, looking for fresh vegetables to create sounds.
It's like cooking, actually. Yeah? You buy something, you buy the vegetables, then you prepare them for, let's say, then the soup, and then the end you eat the soup. And the same process is actually with our concert.
That means new vegetables are bought every morning, shaped in the afternoon, and then used to perform on stage. At the end of the process, the vegetables are literally boiled up into a soup that's served to the audience after the concert, giving fans a fully immersive experience.
Yeah, the audience get to see the music, they get to hear the music, of course, they get also to smell the music, and at the end they get to taste the music too.
Despite a few variations on well-known Kraftwerk tunes, the Vegetable Orchestra is no cover band. They write their own innovative music that involves dark, mysterious underground sounds that fit Vienna's new incarnation as one of the world's capitals of electro sounds.
I think one of the few common interests, the aesthetic interests of all the members, is interest in electronic music and also the history of electronic music, all the things that happened. So that's also what you can find in our pieces.
The music is written in an experimental, collaborative way.
One person has an idea and brings some material, and then we try it out together, and then this person rearranges the stuff.
As the orchestra celebrates its 20th birthday, Matthias believes the members have come on a long journey together.
Of course, before, when we started 20 years ago, it was more, let's say, a student project. At the time now, I think we are more an ensemble. All of us get a musical training. We have like rhythm training, and the music gets, I think, much better.
And despite their longevity, the Vegetable Orchestra still manages to surprise its audiences, which is one of the reasons Susanna Gartmeier remains so committed to this juicy ensemble.
It has been very many times a very nice experience for me that people come with an expectation to go into a kind of a cabaret, and then they realize that it's really meant totally seriously. And after the performance, quite often when we give the soup to the audience, we talk with them, and I really often get this feedback that they think, you opened something up in my head.
Vienna's Vegetable Orchestra, breaking the boundaries of music, then celebrating it with a broth for one of the healthiest nights out you could possibly imagine. Christian Cummins for DW Vienna.
And that's it for today. The programme is produced with help from Helen Sini. The sound technician is Jürgen Kuhn, and I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on SoundCloud and iTunes. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW, in Bonn.